All right. I hope this works because I'm in a new location with a device that I'm not usually on. So hopefully this is coming through okay. Melissa, thank you for joining me. I've become super fascinated with just the emotional and psycho-spiritual implications for health and disease, but specifically German New Medicine. And you're really knowledgeable on German New Medicine, and you're a really rad person. So I figured why not just have you on a podcast to discuss it. So thank you for being here. I want to start really base level. Like, what is German New Medicine, and how did you become interested in it?
Yes. So thank you for having me. I am always down to have this conversation. Because a little bit of my background is I'm a chiropractor. I got into the whole world of alternative health in 2005 and, you know, went to chiropractic school, graduated in 2012, was all about all things alternative, holistic health and healing. So detoxing, nutrition, cleaning up your environment, getting adjusted, exercising, all things health and wellness. And in my career changed a little bit because I started getting really interested in the mind, in the mental component of health, of how I could recommend to my patients to eat well and to exercise and to get adjusted and to do all of the physical, behavioral, external things. Yet there were still things going on pattern-wise within their mental and emotional lives that were not being addressed at all. And so it was my own journey of looking inward, becoming aware of my own patterns, my own thought processes, even though all of my external behaviors were super healthy, there were still some unhealthy patterns within me. So I started on this journey of looking inward and meditation and understanding perception along with my partner. But then I knew that there was a bridge. I didn't know what it was yet. The bridge between the health stuff and the mental emotional stuff. I'm like, there's got to be a link there. And so I started, looking into psychosomatics, but then it found me. It was 2017. I was listening. It was unrelated. It wasn't even about German New Medicine. What I was looking at, I was listening to a podcast about magnesium supplementation, and the woman being interviewed really briefly said German New Medicine in the interview. And then she just carried on with what she was talking about. She just dropped that. And I was like, what is that? I have no idea. So I looked it up and I was dumbfounded. I was so shocked that I had never heard of this entire incredible body of work that this German medical doctor discovered and unpacked following a personal tragedy. So Dr. Hammer's story is in 1978, his 17-year-old son was off on a trip and he got shot. It was like this accidental kind of freak accident of him getting shot. And it happened to be by the Crown Prince of Italy. So there was a lot of politics involved. He ended up struggling to survive for 3 months, had a leg amputation, all sorts of surgeries, but ended up dying in his father's arms. And so obviously this is a huge shock. Your 17-year-old son, is struggling to stay alive. There's all, like I said, there was a lot of politics involved where, the royal family didn't really want a crippled person, didn't really want him to survive because that's, kind of a shame on your name for the, as long as that person's alive. So there was a lot of other stuff in the background. And so after losing his son, Dr. Hammer developed testicular cancer. And, there was no cancer in his family. He had no prior indications of any sort of, disease in his family or in himself. And so he suspected that there was a connection between the loss of his son and the cancer. And then he had a chance to test his hypothesis, and he became the head of this oncology clinic. And so he got to talk to patients and he started noticing patterns. So not only did every man who had testicular cancer, have some kind of shocking situation in his life, but specifically it was the loss. They lost their child, they lost a loved one, and then developed testicular cancer. He noticed that women who had a glandular breast cancer specifically had some type of worry. They were profoundly worried for a loved one or someone in their home. Everyone who had lung cancer had a death fright, some type of shocking thing where they thought they were going to die. And so he started to put together, there is a rhyme and a reason to this cancer that seems to be happening in people, that something specific happens to them, they have a shock, and then their body changes in a certain way. Their tissues seem to be adapting to the specifics of that situation. And then he took it a step further by looking at CT brain scans. He said, okay, so something's happening in this person's life and something's happening on their physical organ. well, the brain, there has to be something going on in the brain because the brain is the mediator for from the outside to the inside. And so on the CT brain scan, he saw that there are these ring formations, almost like when you drop a pebble into a pond, there's like a ripple. There are these circular formations in the brain at specific locations that control specific organs. And so he himself, as he's unpacking and discovering this, and he's having dreams, which is a very interesting part of this whole saga, is he's having dreams of his son, and his son's like, yeah, you're figuring this out, but you have more to discover. And so he's having this experience of putting these pieces together, seeing a pattern emerge that the body and what it's doing, and he thought this just applied to cancer, but he went on to discover that it applies to all sickness. So it applies to cancer, but also applies to a pimple or a hemorrhoid, that there is a specific biological purpose behind every tissue adaptation. And there are a few exceptions with poisoning, nutritional deficiency, and injury. So those things are outside of GNM, but within this framework, within this system, there is an understanding for every disease condition, every sickness that a person develops and can be traced back to a shock that they experienced that set off a cascade of adaptations. So that's like, in a nutshell, the story of what all of this work is.
So fascinating, because I had this perception until you literally just said that, that German New Medicine didn't really account for poisoning or account for malnutrition, but it does. So that really completes the whole picture, which is refreshing to hear. Can you get into the five biological laws next and how he came to discover those?
Certainly. So the first biological law, this is the iron rule of cancer. And so this is all about the shock, the moment in time where the organism is caught off guard. So not just daily stresses are going to initiate biological programs. It has to be something that in the moment you were unprepared for. Your organism is just kind of going along, going throughout life, and then boom, something happens. You're caught off guard. You feel totally isolated in the moment, caught on the wrong foot. And it was something that was dramatic. It was, you know, an important thing just struck you. Something just happened. And so in that moment, the psyche perceives the situation. And so the psyche isn't just your conscious mind. The psyche is your entire signal detection apparatus. It's the part of you that's, you know, determining, okay, do we need to sweat or shiver right now? What's going on in our
body? That include your intuition too.
Yes. It's your intuition. It's the subtle parts that are picking up on all of the dynamics that are going on. So when we use the word psyche, we don't just mean conscious mind, because sometimes people will say, well, I didn't have a conflict because, you know, I was fine. But the thing is if your psyche perceived some type of threat, even if your conscious mind wouldn't label it that way, if we have to work backwards, if you're expressing the symptoms, that does indicate you had a shock of this variety, because the it's like a button that gets pressed in your brain. And so you have to experience the shock in order for the biological adaptation cascade to begin. So I have a feeling attacked conflict. And so in that moment, my body perceives the location where I'm feeling attacked. Let's say you said something to me and I felt like it was an attack, and I perceived it through, you know, my face, like you said something rude to my face. And so my body perceives that as something I need to defend myself against. I need to defend myself against this breach of my integrity, this attack, this, I feel, you know, besmirched by the thing that you said to me. And so the biological program begins. And so depending on the content of the conflict, so what happens and how your body perceived it initiates the adaptation program that's necessary to help you to solve the problem. That's the cool thing, is like your body is always helping you. It's there and it says, I have tools at my disposal. I can proliferate additional cells. I can create a little cellular shield, a tissue shield. Trying to get away from using the word cells, because even, you know, in this model, you know, I'm used to saying the word, but I know that cells are not cells. Cells yeah. Are very strong, but forgive me if I do use the word cells, because that's, this is like, right. You know, the way that I describe it, but it's tissues.
I need to have Tom on, or maybe Harold Hillman, if he's even still alive, because I don't know, to discuss cell theory, because that's a rabbit hole in and of itself, but please continue.
Exactly. So tissue adapts in a way to help you to overcome the conflict that you're dealing with. And so psyche brain organ connection, the psyche brain organ works simultaneously. So it's not like a boom, boom, boom. It all turns on at the same time. The psyche perceives the shock. The brain has the impact, that circle, the Hammer focus is what it's called. That's the impact to the brain. And then your tissues begin to adapt in the way that's appropriate for whatever tissue layer that is. So that's the first biological law, the conflict shock, the psyche brain organ connection. Now, the second biological law is the law of two phases. So this helps us to understand what happens once you have the conflict. And so during our normal day-night rhythm, during the day, the body is more sympathetic active. So we know the autonomic nervous system. We've got the fight or flight. Then we have the rest or digest, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. And so the sympathetic is, you know, during the day, we're hunting and gathering, we're going after things. And so the body is more sympathetic active. And then at night, we shift into parasympathetic. So feed and breed, rest and digest. And then so that's our normal day-night rhythm, up and down. Now, when we have a conflict, when we are caught off guard by this shock, we don't know what to do about it, the mind starts to think. We start to be obsessive about, how am I going to solve this problem? How am I going to solve this problem? Our hands and feet get cold. Our appetite suppresses. And so, you know, so those are, most people are aware, oh, when I'm in fight or flight. But when you're understanding GNM, what you need to start thinking about is specific fight or flight. So specifically, the way my body perceived whatever that shock was, now there's a certain tissue adaptation taking place. Let's say it's a stink conflict. So I am annoyed. I'm just caught up. I'm annoyed. I'm frustrated. I've had it up to here. Yeah, I'm inside. I'm having the sensation of this stinks. So in that moment, there is adaptation within my sinus cavity. There is erosion and widening of the nasal mucosal tissue so I can better sniff out the danger that might be around me. So I can better decide what do I need to do to get rid of this problem. So the biological adaptation always has a functional purpose, and that persists as long as the conflict is going on. So during the conflict active phase, again, we have to start paying attention. When you're in conflict, hands and feet are cold, you're not sleeping very well, you're able to fall asleep, but you like wake up at 3 a.m. with the problem on your mind. That's like a hallmark sign that I'm in a conflict that's unresolved and I need to find a solution to this problem. And in nature, you know, we're solving conflicts really quickly. If you are in a, you know, a death threat situation, either the predator is going to get you, or you're going to get away, or you're going to play dead, and then they leave you alone. And that's only going to last, you know, a few minutes. But humans, we have the capacity to be in conflict for a very long time, to be triggered constantly.
For decades.
Exactly. And so we're constantly getting reminders of our conflict. So we stay in this adaptation phase much longer than was appropriate and normal in nature. And so the adaptation will last as long as it lasts, as long as I'm still in the conflict. Then the moment I resolve the conflict, the body has to set that tissue back to normal. So if during the conflict active phase, we grew extra cells, we need to break those cells down. If during the conflict active phase, we lost cells, we now need to refill those cells. So it's simply, you know, the pendulum. This is just, it is cause and effect. The cause is the conflict, shifts my body into an adaptation phase. Specific tissues adapt according to whatever is necessary to help me to resolve the conflict. I resolve my conflict, and then the tissue has to go back, it goes into healing. Now, when we shift into the healing, the restoration phase, this is when most people think they're sick. This is when you start expressing, oh, I've got my face feels a little warm. Oh, I feel a little scratchy in my throat. Oh, I'm starting to feel fatigued. That's because you were in conflict. You were preoccupied with the problem. And now your body is going into that rest phase. And so when you start feeling symptoms come on, you want to think, what did I just resolve? What did I just chill out about? What just shifted? What news did I get? What, you know, what came through? What resolved for me in order for my body to shift into this healing phase? So the body, depending on, again, how long you were in the conflict, now we swing back the pendulum the other direction to the healing phase. And so the tissue starts restoring, and there's always fluid accumulation when there is healing. you know, so the fluid, it's like this mediator. It allows, you know, new tissues to come in, the stuff that's being broken down to exit. So there's swelling on the organ level and there's swelling on the brain level during this healing phase. So this is when you feel headachy, inflammation. Inflammation is always a sign of healing. It's a sign of tissue restoration. Now the body will get to a point of maximum swelling. And so this is the point at which it's like, okay, now we need to shift the program. We need a big squeeze because we can't just keep swelling and swelling and swelling. We get to a certain set point depending on what's necessary for the healing of that tissue. We get to a certain point of swelling and then the body has a big squeeze. And so you can even think of this like a pregnancy. You know, the pregnancy gets to a certain point of maximum swelling, maximum capacity, and then there's a big squeeze. There's a surge of this sympathetic activity that squeezes the fluid out of the brain and out of the organ. That's called the epileptoid crisis or the epicrisis. So this is this halfway point. When you're halfway through the healing, there's going to be this big squeeze, which can manifest as spasms, as a seizure, as a sneezing fit, as a coughing fit. We have the big squeeze, and then the body shifts into the second phase of healing where more scar tissue is coming in and we're getting back to normal. And then we get back to our normal day-night rhythm. So that's how the second biological law.
Can we touch on that real quick? How hard was that for you coming from chiropractic? Because, you know, my understanding is even a lot of holistic or natural approaches or alternative approaches to health still recognize symptoms of illness as a problem rather than the solution, right? And what you're saying is it's the solution. I've come to the understanding that it's the solution as well. But how hard was that for you to reconcile that? And then also, how hard is it for your patients or clients to reconcile that?
For me, it was everything about this just intuitively fell into place because within chiropractic is a deep philosophy of understanding that the body is wiser than the educated conscious mind and that the body always is doing what is appropriate. Now, in the chiropractic model, you know, the idea that there's misalignments in the spine and the misalignments lead to, you know, dysfunction or malfunction at the organ level, this actually fits so much better with that philosophy that the body is always doing the right thing. And so getting a person out of the mindset that, oh, when my neck hurts, doc, I need you to fix right here because it hurts here right now, to help them to understand that it hurts here right now because you are in a healing phase, does take, you know, some reprogramming. But for me, it really was an intuitive, it made a lot more sense to me than the old model. And I am my mind just goes to what makes the most sense. And so because this model has a complete explanation and understanding for why this happens, you know, I was just able to see it. And then once I started experiencing biological programs with the knowledge. And that's the thing, is this has always been the way that it's worked. It's always worked this way. This is the programming that we arrived with. It's now just the recognition and reforming our understanding of what does it mean to be sick? What does it mean to be inflamed? Because it does still feel uncomfortable. And none of this is you know, makes it so that there's not that discomfort. It does make it so that you're not as panicked about it. You're not making it as much of a problem. Because when I panic about my symptom, we can create a situation where the symptom gets even worse because we can hold on to water when we're panicked, when we're afraid for our life, when we feel like, oh no, this is such a problem. I'm afraid that this is deadly, or I'm afraid that something bad's going to happen. That is the way to amplify all of your symptoms because your body holds on to water. We increase that pressure. So for me personally, it wasn't that difficult to wrap my head around it because the explanation for me made so much more sense. But you know, for the average person, it does take a little bit of, gosh, but I feel so bad. How can something not be wrong right now? We have to zoom out and develop greater awareness, which is really the foundation of this, is understanding and not being just in the moment of the pain. We have to look at how long were you in conflict? How long were you up worried about that problem? That's why we're dealing with what we're dealing with now in this healing phase, is because you were in conflict as long as you were. So it makes it so that a person has to zoom out and they have to develop this greater understanding of themselves as an individual and an understanding of their biology.
Were you skeptical? I want to get to the third and fourth and fifth biological laws, but were you skeptical at first when you heard about these programs essentially that the body runs and their specificity relating to, you know, certain emotional conflict or traumatic event, relating that to a specific symptom that arises? Were you skeptical that like that was the case in every single situation at first? And then what made you, I guess, really, if you were skeptical, break through that barrier, like, oh my God, this is it applies through and through.
So again, the basic explanation of it, I was like, okay, this makes a lot of sense. The way that he's describing, it makes sense to me that the body would do this. You know, that the body has these mechanisms for helping us to survive situations. But then it was seeing it in my own body. So for me, the first experience of a biological adaptation was acne for me. So I just dealt with on and off acne all through my teens, all through my 20s. And I did all of the things. I went through every stage of what is acne? Is it simply bacteria on my skin? And so I would wash my face religiously. I'd put rubbing alcohol. I'm like, if I just kill all the bacteria on my face, I will never have acne, right? Well, of course.
Isn't that so fucked how we used to think that? Because that was me too, because I used to have bad acne.
Terrible. And it was like, so I did all of the things and I just felt cursed. And I asked my mom, why do I have acne? And she goes, well, I didn't have it, but your dad had it. So, you know, that's just that. I was like, okay, so I'm just a victim of my genes. So I just felt bad for myself and dealt with it on and off. And then I found when I got into the chiropractic world, I read this book called Milk, the Deadly Poison. And it talks about milk and how dairy is the source of acne and all of this. And so I'm like, oh, it's a dairy. I cut dairy out. My skin got better for a little while, but I still wasn't consuming dairy, but I would still have acne. So I was like, okay, so it's not that. And I changed my diet and I tried, you know, doing raw vegan for a month to see would that clear my skin up? No, no, no. Then I discovered, oh, gut health. If I just have probiotics and I have sauerkraut, that will do it because it's my skin is a reflection of my gut. And it worked again. I would get these like hits where it seems like it's working, but then I'd still be doing the thing and I'd get the acne again. And then I tried to cut out bad oils and I couldn't eat out at restaurants because every time I ate out at a restaurant, I would have an acne breakout. And I was like, oh, I was convinced it's because of the denatured oils and, you know, I shouldn't be
eating. And then you became fearful of literally everything. And you became one of those obsessive health, like crunchy people that avoids every single toxin available.
Absolutely. And the breakouts kept happening. And so I just, you know, forgot about it until finding this. And so Dr. Hommer's description of why acne happens, it is a feeling attacked or feeling soiled conflict. And so that is the dermis skin, and it provides a shield, a protection. When I feel attacked or I feel soiled, my body activates the biological program to create a little shield to protect me from whatever's soiling me. So sometimes like my dog would lick my face and then I get a breakout there. And it's like, oh, how can that not be bacteria from the dog's mouth getting on my face? Well, the dog also licks my partner and he doesn't get an acne breakout. It's like, what's the deal there? So if it's simply bacteria on skin getting into the pores, why does one person have the bacteria on their skin but not get a breakout, but the other person does? And it has everything to do with personal experience. And so my personal experience of the dog licking my face was, ugh, gross, don't do that. Like I had it, I felt soiled by that, the dog licking my face. I felt, how come other people can eat at restaurants and eat denatured oils and not have an acne breakout? They don't feel soiled by it. But I felt soiled when I ate this food. I had this idea that these oils are inflammatory. They're bad for me. Felt soiled, breakout. And so when I started seeing that, my mind was like, oh, that's how this works. It's my experience, the story I'm telling myself about this food, about the dog licking my face, that is creating my experience of feeling soiled. So my body is defending me by building up a little shield. And then when I wash my face or I, you know, get away from the stimulus, the body breaks it down. And the breakdown, that pus, you know, the pimple, that's the body breaking down and decomposing the shield because it's no longer necessary. And it's like, whoa, that it made perfect sense to me. It was consistent with my experience. And I saw it happening in real time. So that was my first experience. My second one was eating this meatball. I was at my cousin's house and they offered me a bowl of, you know, they were making meatballs and they offered me a bowl of it. And I just didn't even think anything of it. And I took a bite of it and I bit into it. And I'm a big texture person. And I did not like the texture of this meatball. It felt like a frozen meatball. It wasn't handmade. And it was,
So you're a meatball connoisseur. And this was just not a good meatball.
Not even that. It just didn't taste good to me. But I didn't spit it out. Like if I was a 3-year-old child, I would just spit it out. But because I'm an adult and I'm in this group and I swallowed it and then I ate the other one too. And I swallowed it down. And afterwards, my throat started burning. And I started feeling just this, oh, this terrible sore throat coming on. And I went through an entire biological program of what could be considered strep throat, because my throat adapted. It felt my cry in that moment when I bit into that meatball and I was like, I want to spit this out, but I can't. That's the conflict. I want to spit this out. So either I need to swallow it down or spit it out. So the throat, the mucosa can widen to make the passageway bigger. So it's easier for me to either get the thing down or get it up. And then the body has to repair it. So the sore throat and all of the drainage and all of like the uncomfortable feelings I had afterward were simply my throat repairing itself. And it's like, oh, so the tissue can widen so we can build extra cells. And this kind of gets into the third biological law, because you can tell it's like, okay, so different tissues behave in different ways depending on what their biological purpose is. So this yellow group, the yellow group is the endoderm. This is the oldest type of tissue in the body, and it's controlled from the oldest portion of the brain, which is the brainstem. And so Dr. Hammer, you know, he looked at all of this through the lens of embryology and also evolution. And I know there's a lot of different, you know, opinions and perspectives. Sometimes as soon as you say the word evolution, everyone, their brain turns off and they say, oh, I can't even entertain this. Now, you know, whether or not there is actual literal, you know, evolution of organism to organism, or it's simply the way that
adaptations in some way, right?
Exactly. Yep. So just hold those thoughts. If there's a part of you that's like rebelling against this whole model, just stick with it for a while to see a little bit more about the framework so that you can make sense of it. So, you know, the endoderm, think about like the most basic organism that could possibly exist. So just a little, you know, organism that lives out in the ocean. All it does is it takes in nutrients, it processes them, and it expels them. You know, so it's breathing, it's eating, and it's reproducing, and that's it. It doesn't have social function. It's not feeling attacked. It simply is existing. That's the endoderm. Those are the most basic functions in the body, controlled from the brainstem. So our digestive system, you know, our oxygen, taking in oxygen to the lungs, that has to do with this endodermal tissue. And the endodermal tissues, when there is a conflict, they respond by cellular proliferation. So this is all of our glands in our body. So the parotid gland, the tonsils, the prostate gland, and the glands get bigger during the conflict so they can produce more of whatever juice they produce. So the thyroid gland, the prostate gland, you know, so we're producing more saliva, we're producing more thyroid hormone, we're producing more prostatic fluid. When you are in conflict, there's growth of those tissues. The breast gland, we're growing additional tissue so we can produce more breast milk. You see how that works. The lung alveoli, we're producing more tissue so we can better absorb oxygen. And you can see that's very functional. It makes sense that my body would have a mechanism for being able to produce more of something if I'm in a jam. You know, if I'm in a tough situation and I need to, if life or death depends on me absorbing a little bit more oxygen from each breath, of me producing a little bit more prostatic fluid so I could be a little muskier and attract a mate, it's like nature has that programmed in. It's like this is for the advantage of the individual and the species as a whole. We want to survive first and foremost, and then we want to reproduce. That's how life keeps happening. And so these adaptation programs, they just make sense that the body has the capacity to build extra tissue. And that's the interesting thing when, you know, when you look at cancer. Cancer is not a new disease. A lot of people like to say, oh, cancer because of all the toxins that we're exposed to. Cancer has been seen in Egyptian coffin, you know what I mean? In sarcophagus of people from long, long, long time ago, before we had a lot of the toxins that we have now. Because it's not a new disease. It's not a new disease. It is a biological inborn adaptation program in response to shocking conflict. And it does take time to wrap your head around that, because I used to be in the whole boat of toxins cause cancer, and cancer is simply the body trying to wall the toxin off. But when you look at what Dr. Hammer discovered, for example, like a stomach cancer, Dr. Hammer did a test on this test tube. So he took normal stomach mucosa, and then he took cancerous stomach mucosa and put it in like a ball of ground beef with each of the test tubes and then a nutrient fluid to keep the tissue alive. And he found that the cancerous stomach mucosa digested the meat 10 times faster than the normal stomach mucosa. So it's like, oh, it's doing something. It's making it so I can better digest my food, better absorb my food, better get out of this situation. And so when we look at that, it's like, well, how could the cancer be just walled off toxins or the body trying to protect itself? This tissue is actually functional. It's doing something. And so that is just one of the many things that leads me to, this is the model that makes the most sense to me. I think someone, you know, asked about toxins. I feel like more toxin free, I keep my body, the less symptoms of sickness. Absolutely. Because we want to have a clean vessel, you know, and that's the thing, is the difference between no amount of toxin. So like we're adding to our toxic load, but no amount of toxins can activate a specific biological program. And that's one of the things you want to start wrapping your head around, is like, it's a specific biological adaptation program that causes stomach cancer versus lung cancer. Why the difference in the two? You know, like, does the toxin have a specific, you know, affinity for one tissue or the other? Well, that doesn't make sense. You know, why can, you know, somebody be exposed to something, or a whole family exposed to something like mold? One person has fatigue, the other person has allergy symptoms, the other person has, you know, digestive symptoms. It's like, how can the one thing be causing all of these different manifestations if it's not the individual having a totality of experience and their biological adaptations depend on their experience that they're having? So that for me, again, it's just like, this model makes way more sense to me than any of the other models that I've explored.
Real quick on that, you brought up earlier your like disgust with seed oils, right? So let's play with that for a second. How do we both acknowledge that seed oils are not beneficial to human health, so not have the perception that, oh, this is bad for me and I'm going to feel sick because of this? How do you balance those out personally with this new understanding?
Totally. I'm not going to buy seed oils. I'm not going to buy denatured oils. I want to live as close to nature as possible. I want to be having, you know, fats that I would find in nature. I don't want to have, you know, a factory need to intervene to create something for me. So I'm going to do my best to live in that way. However, I'm going to go on trips and I'm going to eat out at restaurants and I'm not going to make it a problem. I'm going to trust that my body is highly adaptable and that I can, you know, eat and enjoy life without being paranoid, without making everything, you know, the biggest deal in the world. Because it's all about the enjoyment and my experience, because ultimately my body, if I trust that my body can extract whatever it needs from whatever meal is available to it. Because that's the thing, is if you were, you know, stranded for 5 days and all that you had on the other end of it was like a meal from Taco Bell, that would be the most nutritious thing that you could ever imagine, because you've been starving for 5 days. That your body would get exactly what it needed from it. And you say, oh no, I can't eat that because of the bad oils. No, you're going to eat it. And so when it comes to just survival and adaptation, I believe that my body is highly adaptable, that it can consume things and get what it needs from it, remove what it doesn't need, but I'm not going to purposely, you know, that's the thing, is it has to do with my self-concept. It's not an alignment for me to just eat out for every meal or to use bad oils or buy the cheapest food available. That's not in alignment with my values. And I do think that when we live in alignment with our values, we are healthier. You know, so I don't have as much split energy. If I'm constantly going against my values, if I'm like, oh, I shouldn't be eating out again, but I eat out again, there's going to be a consequence to that. So, it's a philosophical thing. It's a personal perception of how I look and view my food, how I view enjoyment. Am I allowed to eat out and have fun? Or am I secretly punishing myself? Oh, I shouldn't be doing this. It's that split energy that's the biggest problem.
I feel like it's just a slight shift of intention, right? Because I think a lot of people in the holistic health space do the things that they do because they're fearful of the toxins of the malnourished food or the less nutrient dense food that's sprayed with glyphosate. They're afraid of those things, so then they eat organic rather than it's like, I'm going to eat organic because I love my body and that's what's best for me and that's what's closest to being in harmony with nature. So it's like just a slight intentional shift.
Totally.
Yeah. So, I think we're on the third biological arm? Yes, okay. Yeah. Okay.
So the third is this map, this compass for understanding why which tissues do what they do. So we started with the endoderm. Those are the old brain tissues. This they respond with cellular growth during the conflict active phase. But once the cells grow and then you resolve the conflict, the body has a program for decomposing those extra cells. And that's where the fourth biological law comes in, which is the ontogenetic system of microbes. And so where the microbes play their role. Microbes live in all of our tissues and they just hang out dormant. They're just there on standby. They are seasonal workers. They're not always active, but they're there waiting for their moment. And their moment comes when one of the old brain programs turns off. So we're growing these additional cells. We're growing extra lung cells. We're growing extra breast gland cells. We're growing extra prostate cells. We're growing that tissue. Then we resolve the conflict. Oh, I'm out of the danger. Oh, my child's okay. Oh, I no longer have to worry about this thing. Then the body shifts into that healing phase. Remember, conflict active, that's when we're not sleeping. That's when we're heightened sympathetic. Then we resolve the conflict and we shift into the healing phase. So if the cells were grown during the conflict, they now need to be decomposed. And that's what the bacteria do, specifically tubercular bacteria. So tubercular bacteria, it's kind of this cross between a fungus and a bacteria. It's a mycobacteria. And it has this very important job of decomposing tissue that's no longer needed. So for example, you know, in the lung, and this is, you know, big tuberculosis outbreaks following the end of World War I. So death fright, I'm afraid my son's off to war. Oh, the war's over. Oh, my son's back. What a relief. So all that time when I'm worried about the life of my child, my body is developing a lung tumor. And that tumor is additional cells so I can better absorb oxygen. And I can experience that for myself or on behalf of a loved one. And so once my loved one is safe, oh, what a relief. My body starts to decompose that tumor using my tubercular bacteria. But then I don't feel very good. Oh my goodness, I have a fever and I start coughing up mucus and blood and it's smelly. And everyone's like, oh dear, this seems like a really scary health condition. But actually, this is an expression of health. This is the body doing exactly the appropriate thing. It built the extra cells. Now the bacteria have become active. They're decomposing the tumor. And, you know, when you're decomposing a tumor, small capillaries are going to get broken. There's going to be, you know, blood and mucus, and you're going to be coughing up blood and mucus. This is a totally normal, healthy response once you've resolved a death fright conflict. And a big part of this too is that protein, the tubercular bacteria requires a lot of protein. And this is why people, you know, back in the early 1900s, when people had, you know, were dealing with tuberculosis, the wealthy people survived it, but the poor people didn't. And the wealthy people, it's because they had access to, you know, high quality protein. And where the poor people eating potatoes, where you don't have a lot of protein, you can die because you don't have enough of that nutrition. But the body is doing the right thing. And that's why the idea and the just ridiculous attempt to eradicate tuberculosis is so misguided, because you're misunderstanding its functional purpose. You know, and they've done a great job actually of eradicating it and, you know, pasteurizing milk and getting it out of. So a lot of people today do not have tubercular bacteria. You know, night sweats are another indication that you do have tubercular bacteria. Night sweats are a wonderful indication that your tubercular bacteria have turned on and they're decomposing something. So if you get night sweats, that's a great sign that your body is healing. Now, like I said, a lot of people don't have it. So if you don't have the proper bacteria because of too much sanitation and you weren't exposed to it as a child, the body will simply encapsulate that tumor because it can't get rid of it. You know, so ideally, the little microsurgeon's going to remove it for you. But if you don't have the bacteria, you can't have that removal. So that's how the old brain works. Then we have the orange tissue, and the orange is the mesoderm. And the mesoderm is split into old mesoderm and new mesoderm. The old mesoderm is controlled from the cerebellum, and it behaves similar to the endoderm with cellular proliferation, but it has a different theme. So the old mesodermal tissue has a theme of integrity and protection, whereas the oldest brain, the endoderm, has a biological function of survival and reproduction. And so this one is about integrity. And Dr. Hommer gives the description that this layer formed when organisms moved out of the water and onto the land. We needed an extra layer, an extra barrier of protection from, you know, the UV rays from the sun, from the ground. And so this is where the deeper layer of skin, so the dermis, that's what I've been talking about with acne. It's also the same for something like melanoma, is again, this feeling attacked, feeling soiled, integrity and protection is the theme. So this is also the pericardium, the sac that surrounds the heart, the pleura, the sac that surrounds the lungs. So these inner thick layers that protect the body. And these respond with cell growth during the active phase. And once again, cell decomposition during the healing phase. So that's the old mesoderm, again, controlled from the cerebellum. Then we move into the new mesoderm. The new mesoderm is controlled from the cerebral white matter or the cerebral medulla. And this has to do with all of the connective tissues of the body. So now we have, you know, reproduction and survival. We have integrity and protection. Now we have value and structure. We have the bones. We have the connective tissues of the body. And this one was particularly interesting for me as a chiropractor because this is all of the programs of the bones, the muscles, the joints, the ligaments. It has to do with self-devaluation. So when you are not feeling strong enough, smart enough, fast enough, good enough as a partner, as a friend, as a, you know, performer, as whatever, when your body gets that message. Now, this group behaves in a very interesting way. It's also called the luxury group. So during the active conflict for the new mesodermal tissues, there's loss of tissue. So we've had cell growth up until this point. Now we have cell loss. So when I'm actively devaluing myself, let's say it's a physical performance, I need to be faster. I need to be a better dancer. I need to be, you know, better at what I can need to jump higher, run faster, whatever. The body gets the message, I need to be better. And the way that it responds to, I need to be better, is by eroding the tissue during the active phase. So we have loss of cells during the active conflict. So imagine, you know, you're a gazelle and you're in the herd and you're like, oh, I suck at being a gazelle. I'm so bad at this. I'm, you know, so you are devaluing yourself. Your body is losing tissue. There's erosion in the bone depending on the severity of the conflict. So you're becoming weaker during the conflict. But if you succeed in resolving your self-devaluation conflict and you become more confident and you become strong, your body is going to rebuild that tissue and make it stronger than it was before. People know that when you break a bone and then it heals, it becomes the strongest bone in your body. When you have a self-devaluation conflict and you successfully resolve it, so something happens, your self-esteem is ruined, you feel bad, but then you find a solution and you resolve that conflict, those areas of your body are going to reinforce themselves and make them stronger than they were before. But the problem comes in is when a person is chronically devaluing themselves on and off and on and off, and that's chronic pain. That is, you know, chronic knee issues. This is, I have a bad knee because I had an injury. And this is where something like an injury, you could just have an injury. But if you get it in your head, oh, I suck here now. I'm never going to be able to, you know, snowboard the same again. I've got a bum knee. We start talking to ourselves about how bad our problem is. Then we have this story. And that can become a self-devaluation that started with an injury, but then it became a problem because of the way that you responded to it. And so that's how these tissues function. Cell loss followed by cell amplification, cell reinforcement. Very interesting too, the testicles and the ovaries also belong to this group. And so this biological program has to do with loss. So if you lose a child, so Dr. Hommer lost his child, if you have a miscarriage for a woman, if you you know, lose a family member, you can perceive that as this loss conflict. So there's loss of ovarian tissue, there's loss of testicular tissue during the active conflict. But when you resolve the conflict, there is reinforcement. So a woman who's had a loss that's affected her ovaries and then she's resolved it, her ovary is more enhanced. She produces more estrogen. She becomes more feminine. She becomes more fertile. The man becomes more masculine, more potent because of the conflict. And so that's the thing. If you successfully resolve something from the luxury group, from the new mesodermal category, it becomes stronger than it was before and better able, better capable. So you can see it's just like this again. All of this is so biological. When I talk through and really wrap my mind around like what's happening, it's like, oh, it makes sense that the body would do that. That's
functional. I see what you did there. Biological.
It's biological.
Okay, so are we done on the biological laws now?
One more. Now we're in the red group. The red group is the most recently evolved layer. So this has to do with territory and relationship dynamics. You know, so again, back, these organisms aren't worried about their role in the pack. But when we get into the cerebral cortex, now we're dealing with separation conflicts, territorial loss conflicts, sexual conflicts. Where do I belong in this hierarchy? And so these tissues respond with cellular loss during the active phase. This is the squamous epithelium that lines ducts, for example. So like the bile duct. So the bile duct, we've got our normal duct. When we have a territorial anger conflict or an identity conflict, that duct widens. So we erode the tissue. It gets wider so more juices can pass through it. Then during the healing phase, that those cells are replenished. So we have widening and then we have replenishment. So cell loss and then cell growth is how the red tissues respond. And again, all of this is mapped out in the brain. So we have this objective criteria, which is so incredible about this work, that it's objectively verifiable. We can see on a brain scan all of, you know, we can see there's the impact, then we can talk to the patient, you can talk to them about their experience, you can look on the organ level. And so that's one another thing that lends so much credibility to this system is Dr. Hommer, he would not put it in his chart if he didn't see it happen every time. If there was one exception, it's no longer a law. Wow. It's a theory. It's an idea. And so that's where he tested case after case. He was a scientist, very like a German scientist who was very specific about the way that he was reporting this information. And if it didn't follow the laws, it wasn't a part of the system. And so that's where he looked at it again and again and again, and he never found any exceptions to it. And that is amazing. That doesn't exist in medicine. In medicine, it's all percentages. It's all some of the people, some of the time, sometimes get that. Sometimes they get this. This is every time there is this tissue adaptation, there is always this experience of the individual and this impact to the brain. They're always there. And so that this criteria, you know, is able to be reproduced, which makes this the most scientific model that exists when it comes to understanding health and disease.
How does that work with people who are in denial or are unwilling to admit? Like when, I guess when, what I'm asking is when we say that this applies to everyone, how do we know that for sure? Because is it that for those who may not, I'm trying to think of a specific example with German New Medicine. Like, give me a specific symptom that someone experiences that's related to a specific emotion.
Cervical cancer.
Okay. And what's that related to typically?
Sexual frustration conflict.
Okay. So what if this, you know, this lady comes in with cervical cancer and she's adamant that I've had no sexual frustration conflict. Like that's not true with me at all. How do we, is it that they're putting on a front, or maybe they're in denial, or maybe it's a subconscious thing? How do we determine that that applies in that case?
Yeah. So the thing is if the tissue is responding in this way, you had the conflict, whether or not you realize it. And Dr. Hommer, you know, he would go in front of these boards of university doctors. And so that's like the highest level of verification. So he would, you know, come in and we're going to do 8 cases. And so he would take these cases and he'd go through point by point with, you know, in front of this panel of doctors, this is how this works. And there was an example of a man who, you know, he came in and I guess he was having vestibular issues. He was falling over. And so Hommer's given a brain scan and access to the patient. He looks at the brain scan. He says, oh, there is in the cerebellum in the center, there is a large swelling, which indicated to him that this is his pericardium. He had a pericardial attack against the chest conflict. And he's like, and there's swelling there that's in healing right now. That's why he can't stand up and he's having balance issues because his cerebellum is a small place with a big swelling. And so he starts talking to the patient. He's like, okay, so you had an attack against the chest, and he starts asking questions. So did anybody in your family have a heart attack? Did your dad have a heart attack? Your mom? Do any of your kids have a heart issue? And he just goes through and he's asking all of these questions for an hour, asking questions. And the patient's like, nope, 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 didn't have that. No, I don't have that. No, 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 no. Keep saying no. And, you know, and the doctors that are on this panel are like, all right, Hammer, maybe it's not always like that. Maybe, you know, this person didn't have the thing. Maybe there's other things that can cause it. And Hammer, again, knowing what he knows, when he looks at this map, he's like, this is how the biology functions. Whether or not this individual is aware of their own experience, you know, that it's pretty unlikely that they're very aware of their own experience, but the biology doesn't lie. The brain scan doesn't lie. You had this conflict. Now we're just, he kept digging. And so he said, did you ever have a dog with a heart issue? And all of a sudden a light bulb went off in the patient. And he was like, oh, and he remembered something that happened 20 years ago. We heard a dog barking in his backyard, and there was a festival the next day where they eat goose. And so he goes to the backyard, the dogs are barking, and he sees a goose thief. So someone's about in the backyard trying to steal his goose, so he would have one for the festival the next day. So he goes out to confront the goose thief. The goose thief turns around and has an axe in his hand and chops it at the man and hits him right in the chest.
Whoa.
And so clear, how much more clear of an attack against the chest conflict, but it was 20 years ago. And probably the man's brain blocked it out because it was a really traumatic and shocking event. And so, and you know, the guy ended up surviving, but he stayed on the track. He lived in the same house for 20 years where the goose thieving, you know, almost happened. And so he was on the track for 20 years. Then he was having some other health issues and his son moved him to the city. So he wasn't living in the country home where the attack against the chest happened. So 20 years later, he comes into healing from that. So it's just amazing because it's the questioning. So the woman who says, I never had this conflict. I don't know what you're talking about. This, if you have the symptom, you had the conflict, whether or not you're aware of it. And so we have to ask the right questions and, you know, try to help you to connect those dots. But yeah, so don't just disregard it if something immediately doesn't come to mind, because we do, the psyche suppresses, the psyche will hide things from you. A lot of the biological programs that have to do with the red group, the cerebral cortex, the separation conflicts, part of it, you get memory loss. The memory loss is functional to help you to forget the person you want to separate from or the situation. It's helping you to forget. So just because you can't remember it doesn't mean it didn't happen. And in fact, you know, it's even more curious. It's like, I wonder what did happen. So, and this doesn't mean we want to uproot and, you know, remember every bad thing that's ever happened to us, because there are some conflicts we want to just leave them alone. We don't want to resolve. I was going to ask
next is like, how do we go about resolving those things then?
Yeah. So there are conflicts we don't want to resolve. So conflicts that have lasted for longer than 9 months that belong to the red group, they're better left where they are, you know, because if you resolve them now, you could experience such a huge healing that you might not be able to survive through it. So there is, like, within the psyche, there is a balance that the body comes to. We also have these things called constellations, which is where you have a bombardment of multiple conflicts and the body, the brain is vibrating differently, but it finds like kind of a level of harmony. So people who have quirks, psychological quirks, unusual things about their personality, it's likely that they have constellations of ways that they've adapted to the bombardment of trauma and shock that they've had in their life. But the body does find like its own harmony. So we don't, that's why we want to look at what's worth resolving. What do I want to resolve? You know, things that
that's on an individual basis then, right?
Always. Everything about this is always on an individual basis. We can't give, there is not a patent solution for any conflict. It's always 100% I wasn't there when you had your conflict. I don't know what it's going to take for you to bring peace into your nervous system, to feel as though that's no longer an issue. Because that's, a conflict is resolved when it can't happen again. Mm-hmm. When what happened then can't happen now. And
I think I've seen you say this before, that it's like, if you can look back on it and laugh about it, then you know that it's resolved, right?
Yeah, that's another indication. If I can laugh about it, if I deeply know that, like, I'm such a different person now, the situation is so different, what happened then can't happen anymore. But if there's a part of me that's like, that could happen again, the body will keep the program and it will not fully release it. And so that's where you have to look at your life. What was going on at the time? What has to change? Because really all of the biological, you know, everything that's going on with your body, it's pointing you to where you're out of alignment with your biological code. You're living, if you're dealing especially with some type of chronic issue, there's some area in your life that is misaligned with your biology, that you're not living in harmony with nature. You're not living in harmony with what you were, you know, designed designed for biologically. You know, people working, you know, the graveyard shift, that's not a biologically designed lifestyle, which can create all sorts of, you know, conflicts for an individual. And so you might have to change jobs. You might have to. So one of the teachers that has taught me so much, the late Helmut Pilhar, his daughter, Olivia, she had a liver cancer, and her biological program started when her mother went to work. They were building a new house, and so they moved in with their in-laws, and the mom was off at work. And so the daughter was with the grandma, and she's like, I'm not eating. She didn't eat if the grandma was with her, but when the mom came back, she would eat again. And so, but when the mom went to work, she'd stop eating. So she had a starvation. And so the child, like, oh, you don't psychologize with the child. You stop going to work. You have to practically change your life in order for that child to get biologically what she needs. Biologically, what she needs is her mother. There's no amount of explaining to her, oh, mommy's going to be back on, you know, on these days of the week, and you're going to be just fine, and grandma's here, and she's going to feed you. She's like, I'm not eating. She was in conflict every time her mother was away. So they had to rearrange their life in order to help their child to resolve their conflict. And it's how willing are you to do that, to live in harmony with your biology, rather than to live, you know, according to the, you know, the world where we go to work and we make money and we do things. It's like the biology has a different thing in mind.
Can we touch on that a little bit deeper now? The expression of symptoms in kids, especially much younger kids, as it relates to their parents. So from my understanding in Germany medicine, oftentimes symptoms will arise in toddlers or in infants because of something that the parent is experiencing, right?
Totally. Because the child is having an experience of your experience. You know, they're feeling, they're picking up on your annoyance, your dissatisfaction, your desire to separate, you know, and so they, you know, and there's a couple of schools of thought. There are some teachers who talk about, like, the child just takes on the conflicts of the parents. It's my understanding that Dr. Hammer explained it as the child's having their own experience. So they're having their own shock related to what you're dealing with. And so, you know, whether they take it on one-to-one or they're having their own experience, I do think that some children, you know, have more, you know, differentiation between parent and child. They see themselves, you know, as an individual at different stages of their experience, but especially for little ones, especially for, like, you know, the baby doesn't know that they're not their mother. It's just this whole totality of this experience where they're like one. And so the child is mirroring and experiencing everything that the mother is. So even if the mother's not expressing a separation conflict or a rash, this actually, you know, a mother who's like, my baby has never left my side. I've never been separated from the baby. Like, I attachment parent, I free birth, all the things. Why does my baby have a rash? And it's like, well, what are you dealing with? Who do you want to separate from? And as soon as I said that, the light bulb went off and she knew what it was, who she wanted to separate from. And it's like, oh, wow, my baby is picking up on my desire to separate from this relationship, to separate from this situation. And so that's where we do. We have to just get curious. That's really the key here, is curiosity and interest. And not, you know, if somebody just poo-poos this right away and says, no, that's not how it works, you're missing out on an opportunity to really get to know yourself, really get to know your child in this deep biological way that just nothing else gives you this type of insight, other than to know, well, apparently that's how I felt about it after I get the symptoms. Sometimes I'll even, you know, express symptoms every now and then. I'll be like, huh, okay. You know, it was actually right after Thanksgiving, I had a can't swallow conflict. And I was like, that was very interesting to me. The reasons for it. And I saw it, and it was a very, you know, it allowed me to expand my self-understanding, expand myself personally, to evolve my person. Because if I didn't see what I saw then, you know, I could persist in some measure of conflict with regard to this particular topic that I couldn't swallow. So it's like this, it's such an opportunity for you to get to know yourself and how you really feel, because your biology doesn't lie. We can psychologize, we can pretend, we can say, oh, it's not this, and your the stink conflict, that's the dead giveaway. Stink, when someone in your vicinity is sneezing, something annoyed them, something irritated them, and they're
I've been sneezing so much the last 2 days, and that makes a lot of sense.
Yep. And so something stinks, this, yep. You know, and so when my partner sneezes, this is actually a great story. Steve, my partner, one day I was in here doing sessions and I hear him out there in the hallway and he sneezed like 8 times, like hardcore, like the loudest sneezes. I'm like, what is going on out there? And later on in the day, I asked him, I was like, what was that? Were you annoyed with me? Like, what stink conflict did you have? You know, and at first he's like, I didn't have a stink conflict. He's like, I actually had a really lovely morning. And as he's saying, I didn't have a stink conflict. I don't think it was anything. His hands were on the counter and he was picking something up. And the thing he was picking up was this tongue scraper that we had gotten like 10 years ago. And he used this tongue scraper, this metal, you know, tongue scraper every day. And that morning when he was using it, it broke while he was using it. And he shouted, like, I remember that morning, he shouted and he was like, this broke. And the thing that stunk to him is he said that he had no indication. It wasn't like it was getting weak. He said that it just broke like out of nowhere. And he was just shocked that it happened. And that's one of the things too, is he couldn't sniff out the danger. He couldn't sniff out that this was going to happen. He didn't suspect it. And it was an annoyance all of a sudden. And so that's what it was. It was him resolving the conflict of like being shocked by, and again, how benign is it to, you know, this thing, but it was sudden. It was unexpected. He was caught on the wrong foot. And so that's where, you know, even if you're being aware and a conscious person doesn't mean you can't experience something in a moment that catches you off guard. So it's not like we're trying to prevent. It
just means you can resolve the conflict much quicker, right?
Much more quickly when you bring that awareness to it. So, but it's not the idea is to never express symptoms ever. Like you're human. You're going to have moments, times when you're caught off guard, but you want to use it. It's like, oh, that's just so interesting that for him is what resulted in this like crazy sneezing fit and like massive drainage. But that's how you can start to pay attention to this in your life. Like little sneezes, little experiences. I mean, I'll get sensations every now and then or like of pain or just like a tingle. And it's like, there's something there that doesn't come from nowhere. Like I used to wonder, why do I just itch all of a sudden? Like some area of my body is like super, super itchy. And it's because of a separation conflict that's in healing. When you are itchy, that is the healing phase of the tissue restoring itself.
Wow. 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 I have a question related to symptoms of COVID, and I've pulled up the CDC symptoms of COVID, and just for everyone's understanding, Melissa and I are both of the position that there is absolutely no virus whatsoever. But of course, COVID-19 as a disease, it really is just a bunch of symptoms that they've decided to put together and label a new disease, which is another conversation in and of itself. But so here they are: fever, chills, cough, shortness of breath. Let's go with the big ones that a lot of people talk about, like new loss of taste or smell. What does that relate to with German New Medicine?
Stink conflict. So stink conflict, we have the nasal mucosa, but then we also have the olfactory nerve. And so if there's a stink conflict, something I don't want to smell, that you will lose nerve function of the olfactory nerve. So we shut off certain scents. So this is unrelated to like COVID in particular, but there was a person who, you know, had a new baby and, you know, was getting used to changing diapers. And she found that she stopped being able to smell she didn't want to smell like the dirty diaper, and her scent conflict was literally not wanting to smell something. So the brain turned off her ability to smell. And so you can see it was a functional adaptation to not wanting to smell something. So
that might be one you don't want to heal, because I don't want to smell dirty diapers. Right? I have a toddler right now.
There you go. And so, so a person who still has an issue with taste or smell, there's a stink conflict. There's something that you don't want to smell. This can be either wanting to smell something and not getting the smell, or wanting to not smell something, you know. So what do you not want to smell? What stinks to you? What is a smell you want to block out that will turn off your body's ability to register scent, which also obviously will affect your ability to taste food. And so I've known many people who had COVID, who had an experience, had an adaptation, and they're
listening. She did air quotes for those who aren't watching the video. She did air quotes.
Had it. And then they persisted in not being able to smell certain things. It's like, okay, well, there's still a conflict around certain things that you are not wanting to smell. And this is an opportunity for you to get curious. you know, because again, I don't know what it's going to be that's going to allow that scent to come back, your ability to smell things. There's a resolution that only you can access, and you're going to do that through curiosity, not through, oh, I just had this terrible, stupid virus and it's causing me this problem. No, because when you do that, you put yourself in the role of a victim. You put yourself in the role of, there's nothing I can do about this. Poor me. I encountered the bad little particle and now I can't smell anything. Well, that puts you in a position where you can't do anything, but this puts you in a position where you can get curious. You can pay attention. Who was in my life? What was annoying me? Who did I want to smell? Who did I not want to smell? What was bothering me? What's really going on here? And that allows you to dig into the layers of your psyche to get to know yourself. And you resolving your conflict in this way is going to be, you know, so much more helpful for you as an individual rather than, you know, just writing it off as, you know, a virus that caused it.
I guess the second one I want to touch on is, and we were talking about this a little bit before, is hypoxia and like inability to absorb oxygen essentially. So what would that relate to with German New Medicine?
So when we're looking at like the cough, you know, related to COVID or what they're calling COVID, what we have to look at, what is going on in the bronchial tubes? So, you know, where are we having this problem? The bronchial tubes respond to, the bronchial mucosa responds to a territorial fear conflict. And so this is some type of threat in my territory. I'm feeling unsafe. You know, I'm afraid of someone leaving my territory. I'm afraid of someone coming into my territory. That
makes a lot of sense.
Right. And so the suspicion that someone in my vicinity could be unsafe. So what's happening during the active conflict is we are widening the bronchial mucosa. So again, that's the red group where we lose cells during the active phase. So we make the bronchial tubes wider so that we can bring in more oxygen, so we can get out of this dangerous situation. We can, you know, leave this threat in our territory. Then when we go into healing, so when a person is in healing from the bronchial tubes, from that territorial fear, the bronchial tubes, they heal and there is there's shrinkage. So we have less air coming in. So this shortness of breath and hypoxia, we have less oxygen able to get through the tube, because if I eroded a lot of tissue and now there's swelling, now if we add water retention on top of that, so now we're panicked because we have the scary C word and now we might get put in isolation or we might get put in quarantine. So now I'm isolated. I'm holding on to even more water. So think about the bronchial tube. So here's the normal bronchial tube. We widen it during the conflict active phase. Now we're healing it. So it's swollen. So when it's swollen, this is when it's hard to breathe. This is when you're coughing. This is because we're in this repair phase. Then we add water retention on top of it. And the tube's like this now. So you can't get much oxygen in. So of course you're going to have hypoxia, because not much oxygen is able to make it through those tubes when they're all swollen up and you're so panicked. So that's the problem, is because you're in the healing and we're adding panic on top of the healing, and we're telling you, you've got some scary, you know, scary, highly contagious virus that's going to cause you to possibly go in the hospital and be on a ventilator. Can't you see how all of these tubes are like closing up and people are turning blue and not able to get any oxygen in, and they're having this issue? It's like, well, that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I brought this up, I think, the last three episodes that I've done, but it still fits perfectly with this. So why not bring it up again? According to the CDC, the second strongest risk factor for death associated with the COVID label was fear/anxiety related disorders. So what that indicates again is that it's people who are in a perpetual state of fear and anxiety. And that fits right into what you're saying with regards to German New Medicine. So it all just makes so much sense. So I want to ask now, and I know that it's individual. What are some ways that you find to be most helpful in resolving these conflicts? Because I would imagine that it's very psychosomatic, and you're having to do somatic processes to get this out of the body, right? So what are some things you've found to be helpful tools to resolve this, or to resolve conflicts in general?
So first, just understanding this model. Understanding the framework, understanding the why symptoms happen in and of itself can bring so much peace, where like you're not afraid, because we tend to amplify a problem when we're afraid of our symptoms. When we think, oh no, I'm bleeding, or there's blood in the toilet. It's like, oh my gosh, this is so scary. But if you understood that blood in the toilet means that you've resolved an indigestible morsel conflict and your body is healing, or blood in your sputum, like blooded at any time, it's like, oh, that's actually an indication that my body is healing. So that in and of itself is helpful. But then when we look at like, what's the issue in my life? The indigestible morsel, what can I process? What am I angry about? What stinks to me? Who am I missing? What do I want that I don't have? How am I feeling about myself? All of that, we have to become aware. We have to pay attention to what we're telling ourselves. Because, you know, most like one-time conflicts, things that just happen, you know, one freak thing, and then you have some symptoms and they go away. It's just a one-time thing. It's when we're dealing with long-term chronic issues, there's an attitude that you've developed. There's a concept that you have of yourself where you are seeing yourself or other people in a certain way. You have to understand what this story is, and you have to like learn how to do something different. You have to become a different person. And so that's where, you know, what it's going to take for someone to resolve their self-devaluation. Maybe you need to practically get into a different field. You need to do something different in your life. That's always the first level. Let's look at what practically can you change about your life? Because that's going to be the most effective type of conflict resolution, is going to be a practical change. This is what works with kids and with animals, is a practical change of environment. Oh, you're going to daycare and you hate it. Okay, no more daycare. Oh, we're doing this thing and we have to change practically. You can't, again, psychologize and help a child to change their attitude about something. But then there's situations. There's a woman I worked with who had terrible psoriasis. And it flared up really, really bad after she got a divorce. So she'd been wanting to get a divorce from her partner, who was kind of emotionally and verbally abusive. And she's like, okay, I want out of this relationship. And so she ends the relationship, but then she's got terrible, thick psoriasis between her breasts and on her belly. And it was just like inflamed and angry. And she's like, what do I do about this? So she, you know, hires the best naturopath and takes all the supplements and is getting sun exposure and doing, you know, saunas and detoxes and literally all of the things. Yet the psoriasis persisted. Then we started working together and we're talking about, what's the separation conflict? Who do you want to separate from, or who do you want contact with? She's like, well, I got this divorce. And so I wanted to separate from him for many years. However, she had a 9-year-old child. And now the child had to go with the ex-spouse. That's wow. The law. And so she couldn't access the practical resolution is your son stays with you all the time forever, and he never has to go with the man that you don't want him to go with. That would be a practical resolution. Yep. But for her, that wasn't a possibility. So we had to look through her experience. Okay, so when was this getting reactivated? Every time she got a text, every time there was a court appointment, every time there was a family therapy meeting, every time she would be wanting to hold her child close, wanting to push the ex away, hold the child. And this is, where do you hold your baby? Right here, right exactly where the psoriasis was showing up. She wanted to hold her child close. And every time he was away, she was worried that he was being emotionally traumatized and all this stuff. So we had to get her thinking differently. And it was a persistent effort for her to look at this through a new perspective, start seeing opportunities instead of imagining him being traumatized every time he goes with his father. Imagine they're having a good time. They're having a nice relationship and I get free time. So it's like, focus on what you can do. Stop. She was living in the problem, and the work we did together helped her to start living in the solution. And it was September, April. It took her a few months of really working on this, cleared up completely.
Wow.
It was really amazing. But it was persistent effort on her part because her life circumstances was still inviting her to feel this fear, this desire to bring her son close and to push that person away. That still remained. But she had to access a higher solution to the problem because she couldn't practically change the situation. And so first we want to try practical if possible, then we can access, you know, something, a shift in our consciousness that changes our relationships, and we can transform how we feel about the problem.
So fascinating, because that like makes so much sense. What you said, the psoriasis showing up right where she held her child. That's incredible. What are some other, like, I guess, mind-blowing moments as a German New Medicine practitioner that you've had where it's like, wow, maybe someone had a really heightened form of cancer, maybe stage 3 or stage 4 cancer, just anything that comes to mind in terms of what you've seen in healing and resolving conflicts.
I mean, the every time I talk to a person and we make the connection, it blows my mind. It's like, of course, it's this, you know, it's something like an STD, you know, the whole idea like, oh, STD, it's a virus. It's something that passes from genital to genital. It's like, no, there's an experience happening. Mm-hmm. There's a regret the next day. Ooh, I shouldn't have had that conflict right there. And it's like, ooh, why did it show up right there? It's like, that's where I really didn't want to have contact. I wished I did not have that. And that separation conflict leading to something like herpes, you know, something like a self-devaluation conflict, very severe. So anemia develops when you have a severe self-devaluation conflict affecting your bones. You know, so we even say our language, the idioms, the things that we say, I felt it to my bones. I felt it in my bones. Why do we say that? Or I wanted to bite his head off. Or I feel sick to my stomach. Oh, I can't stomach that. All of this language is a mirror for exactly what's happening. I couldn't stomach it. I couldn't digest it. I couldn't bite. So dental issues, jaw issues is a bite conflict where I want to bite someone, but I have to hold back. I want to chew you out, but I have to suppress it. And so that there's the conflict. So with the bones, someone dealing with, you know, after they had an embarrassing situation, they had a severe self-devaluation conflict and they started developing anemia. So weakness, fatigue, they're pale, they, you know, get diagnosed with anemia. Now, anemia is when there is decomposition or breakdown within the blood production cells in the bones. So we lose cells, that's the new mesodermal group. We lose cells during the conflict. And then when we resolve it, so this person who, you know, they dealt with this embarrassing situation, they worked through it, they started seeing it in a different light, they started doing different things in their life in order to, you know, like build their confidence back. It was like, okay, well, this happened. This was embarrassing. It was in this particular field of your life. It's like, let's find somewhere else where you can start feeling good about yourself, where you can start performing in a way that you're like, oh, I did a good job, where you can start rebuilding your self-value and your self-esteem. And so when they start rebuilding their self-esteem, then they get the swing back. So during the conflict, we have anemia, we have loss of blood production cells. Then during the healing phase, we have an increase in blood production cells. So they develop leukemia. And so leukemia from the conventional perspective is, oh no, the blood is doing something wrong. There's too many white blood cells. And they call it cancer. They call it a disease. They think that your body is doing something wrong. They say that this is terrible and you need to do chemo right away. You need to do this, you know, we need to destroy all of the bone marrow and we need to give you stem cell, you know, transplant. We need to do all this crazy stuff. But leukemia is a sign of healing. Leukemia is the indication that the blood is building back up. These white blood cells, it's the body turning back on the blood production capacity. And so that person, rather than going down the road of, you know, intense treatment, they trusted their body and they continued with that self-revaluation. Because, you know, again, if you go back into the conflict, and that's where most people find themselves as they start to resolve something, they start getting symptoms of, you know, leukemia. But if they reactivate that conflict, oh, no, I have a scary disease now. Now I'm really broken. Now something's really wrong with me. And so they get into a vicious cycle. And so this wisdom, you know, one of my mentors says, you want to learn this while you're healthy. Learn it now before you ever have a diagnosis, because once you have a diagnosis, that is, you know, it's a spell cast on your mind. You are, you know, given this, ooh, you've got something scary. You've got something bad. And then he's like, it's like trying to teach a drowning person how to swim. Yeah. And that's what we want to know beforehand, so that should you ever have any adaptations where you're like, ooh, this is an intense adaptation, but you know, this is an adaptation. It is a specific response to a specific situation that I dealt with. Now I need to maintain my resolution and understand what my body is doing so I don't panic.
Question I have on cancer specifically is, and maybe I already have the answer in my mind. You correct me if I'm wrong on this. The reason that there is a higher prevalence of cancer in modern society from a Germany medicine perspective is not because of the increase in toxins or any of those things, although toxins do lead to disease, which Germany medicine recognizes to some degree, right? It's that in the modern age, we are living in constant, like according to the fifth biological law, conflicts on that end. Because we're so disconnected from nature and disconnected from ourselves, and that's why cancer proliferates, or there's more cases of cancer.
Yes, I would say so, yes, because we are living more unnatural lives than ever before. And then also screenings. So when we screen and we constantly are looking for cancer and then we're getting told, and that's the thing is that's like the, like when you get told, when you get diagnosed with something, that tends to be just this cascade of additional conflict. Because when you get told by someone in a white coat who looks, peers into your body, looks into their crystal ball and says, oh, you've got this scary problem, that energetic exchange, the conflict shock that comes with a diagnosis is typically the thing that leads to that person's demise. It's the ongoing fear that something's wrong with me, that I have a scary disease now. And so I think that the constant screenings and looking for a problem and seeing something really, I know young women who I went to high school with, at least two who, you know, got diagnosed with breast cancer and, you know, went through treatment, went through surgery, did the whole deal. And, you know, these things very likely would have gone away on their own if they hadn't been looked at. You know, there's actually a great story of this, I guess, a physician's assistant, I think, in Germany, where she was tasked, I guess her job was to let people know that they had abnormal cells on their pap smear. And like that was, and what she did is she buried the info, anybody that had an abnormal cell reading on their pap smear, she kind of, I don't know how she got away with it, but she buried the information in the file and the person, people never found out about it. And then eventually, you know, one of the doctors, got found out that basically this person who's supposed to be reporting these abnormal cells, it was like 153 or 154 cases where people weren't told that they had these abnormal cells. And so I think she, you know, went to trial and all of this stuff, but all of the women who weren't told were totally fine. And one of the women actually thanked the person, the perpetrator, because she's like, if I would have found this out, I would have been so freaked out. I would have had probably unnecessary intervention, unnecessary, you know, radiation or chemo or something. And because she didn't find out, she didn't do anything. And her body just, you know, because again, we're having adaptations all the time. And if you just get a snapshot at the wrong moment and they see something, it's simply a moment in time. Your body, if you resolve that conflict, was going to get rid of it anyways. It was going to go away. But now you have something and now you start to identify with it. And now you have to go through, you change your diet. You go through all of these like changes, which for some people is a good thing. Some people get diagnosed with something and they find the whole world of healthy living and it turns out to be a good thing for them. Yeah. But again, when it's based off of fear, we want it to be based off of understanding, not based off of fear.
Well, people go the opposite direction though, too, where they get the diagnosis and then they look at that so-called authority figure in a white coat and they're like, ah, he knows better than me. I must listen to what he says. And then they start receiving like immunosuppressive drugs or drugs that actually increase the toxicity of their body, perpetuating the problem. Then they're in a perpetual state of fear. And it's just so nefarious, the labeling of specific diseases. That's what it leads to.
Exactly. We did back to the biological laws really quick. 4 and 5, 4 was the microbes. 5 is the quintessence. So that's overall beautiful, tying it all together. There's nothing in nature that's meaningless. You know, so really getting this understanding, nature doesn't do anything evil. There's nothing malignant in nature. Nature only does what is sensible. And I just love that, like to get out of the idea that there could be anything evil or scary or malignant in your body. Dr. Hammer discovered that what we think of as metastasis, this idea that the scary cancer that's at point A can move to point B and point C, and it's going to spread all over the body. Think about how scary that idea is. Just the, you know, I'm a very visual person. So like I make pictures in my mind of what this is like, of like this scary entity that's going to spread out malignantly throughout my body. But when you see cancer as a specific adaptation that's meaningful and sensible, the body doesn't do anything against itself. It's only for its own survival. You understand that if there's any additional cancers that show up in a person's body following an initial diagnosis, it's simply additional conflict. So the bones, self-devaluation, the lungs, death fright, the liver, starvation. So the cancer does not spread. And if that's the one message you take away from this, is just to get out of the fear of cancer spreading as this scary malignant process, that would bring so much peace to an individual who either has a disease or, you know, is afraid of something like this happening in their body.
I actually know someone who worked with you and they had a specific type of cancer and they resolved that through working with you by understanding what related to that. Hers was ovarian cancer specifically, and she was able to resolve that just by coming to understand German New Medicine. So I know I can even say firsthand that I've seen people have success with this. So I can't imagine what you've experienced. Okay, so for my last question, and for those who have questions, Melissa will be doing a Q&A for the WayForward membership on the 6th of January. So really looking forward to that, because I'll probably come with like 5 or 6 more questions myself. But this is the last one I want to end with. And it's kind of funny, but kind of not. I'm kind of serious because I've been exploring this myself. Have you like thought about the possibility that we live in a simulation because of the programs that the body runs? Like the fact that the body runs specific programs, like, can somehow in my mind sound very simulation-y. But like when I say simulation, I'm not meaning that there's some overarching controllers who are running things. I mean like more of like a cosmic simulation, if that makes sense. But have you explored that possibility in your mind, given that there's like these very specific biological programs that we run?
I like the description that Ernest Holmes gives just for, you know, creation and existence and evolution, that it is this, you know, this process of ever increasing expansion that, you know, in a sense, and I, you know, this is Alan Watts, you know, also talks about like the Hindu perspective of God, and, you know, God likes to play games. And I think that God plays games through, yes, creating these simulation worlds of, you know, let's start with these organisms, and these organisms are going to adapt to this environment, and they're going to just keep adapting and changing and adapting and changing and growing and adapting and changing until the point, and Ernest Holmes talks about this, until the point where they become conscious. And then the evolution, instead of being compulsory, it is self-directed, you know, and so like the organisms develop, and they're just kind of doing their thing, and they're adapting to their environment, and they're changing, they're growing, and they're doing this like this cool evolutionary process. And then at some point, there's so many connections within the brain as things develop and as things grow and as experience accumulates, we start having a certain number of connections, and then we wake up inside of the simulation. We wake up within. And when we wake up, then our evolution is self-directed. And we can use just this ancient wisdom of the biology. And that's the thing, is this biology has been here for, you know, supposedly millions of years, accumulating knowledge and wisdom and adaptation. And now I've got this mind has only come online within what, the last 5,000 years, that we've had this self-conscious reflective ability to create language and to, you know, evolve in these other ways. And so I see it all as a game. I see life as a game of this experience, as of waking up, and then to recognize the biological suit that we came in, and to understand, I've got a modern mind, I've got an ancient body. This body has been here a really long time. It's accumulated a lot of adaptive wisdom. I love thinking about the fact that my body can do what it does. It means that this adaptation that my body possesses allowed an ancestor to survive, you know, like think about all of the ancestors that had to survive in order for your physical meat suit to be here today. It's a lot. Yeah. And it had to accumulate that knowledge and that wisdom through trial and error. And, you know, it was the trying it out. Let's see if this adaptation can confer a survival advantage. You know, so I guess bridging this understanding of like this biological nature but then we have the spiritual consciousness that is awakened within the biology. I think it's a big, beautiful, really fun and interesting game.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to emphasize the point that it's not like a dark simulation where there's like overlords looking down on us, manipulating us. That's not what I meant by that. It's like a beautiful cosmic simulation. So it's really cool reflections you had there. Melissa, this has been awesome. We've gone like an hour and a half, and I felt like it was like 30 minutes. Time flies when you're having fun. This was a fun conversation. So thank you for joining me. And is there anything you want to plug, or any other last thoughts or things you want to share?
Yeah. So I have, someone asked about books there. If you go to my website and go to the blog, I have a whole post of a bunch of different books and training courses and programs that you can get involved in to learn more, because really this is, everyone's got to learn this for themselves. This is you as an individual. You need to know the map for your biology. So when you have a symptom, there's a course you can go to and learn all about that body part, learn all about the biological program, study about it, learn about, get interested in it. Because once you download the program, this is a stink conflict. Oh, this is an indigestible morsel conflict. This is, I can't hear this conflict. I can't see this conflict. This is how this, you know, this is how this, this whole system works. You become empowered. And nothing can replace that personal empowerment of personal experience. And so, you know, that's my role, is in helping people to more deeply understand it and then to apply it, to use the wisdom. So all of the courses that I have on my website are about, how do I apply this? How do I use my consciousness to resolve, unravel this knot, to untangle this problem? And so that's what you get when you, with my Resolve courses. And then I also offer Awareness School, which will be starting up again in January, which is about awareness. It's about being able to see my perceptual faculty. Why am I the way that I am? Why do I see things through the lens of abandonment? Why do I see myself in the way that I do? Why do I see money in the way that I do? Why do I relate to things in the way that I do? And the more deeply you can understand yourself and how you show up and how you perceive things, you can start to rearrange it in a way that's more resourceful, in a way that brings greater peace into your body, greater prosperity in your life overall. And so there's a lot of different avenues you can take, but I think that that blog post will help you to find and connect you with books and resources to learn more about this amazing system for understanding the body.
Rad. Thank you for that, Melissa. And again, for those who are listening or watching on January 6th, if you have any other questions for Melissa, you'll be able to ask her as part of the Way Forward membership. And again, to become a member, just click the link in the show notes. So thanks, Melissa. This was awesome. See you on January 6th.
Awesome. Thank you.